Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat number 46, the first for 2010. And this is Michael Loft. We welcome all of you tonight for our topic, which is emergency preparedness. We hope you'll join us for our coverage of ATIA in Orlando, Florida. Coming up in 3 weeks, Serotalk will be there on the 28th and 29th, doing interviews with various vendors and trying to share with you all of the new announcements and new products and developments and things going on there. Of course, Blind Bargains will be there as well, so JJ will be hanging out, and so between the two of us, we'll hopefully capture everyone. Certainly, there are a few folks. I'm sure you can guess one who doesn't wish to be interviewed by yours truly or Serotech. But tonight's topic is emergency preparedness. So a few of the questions I'm going to ask you later when we open up the forum for discussion are, A, have you ever had to evacuate? Do you, or have you ever had any kind of preparedness kit, had stored food, planning for an outage of electricity or an ice storm or an approaching hurricane where you had to gather up supplies, maybe even something simple like a first aid kit? Or for that matter, have you even gone through a hurricane? And what is that like? I hear that's a pretty emotional experience. Had an extended period without electricity, and what was that like? Or have any of you ever had to stay in a shelter and talk about what that was like, being with a group of other people? And, you know, if you had a service animal and what issues that may have presented. So what I'm going to cover here, mainly some tips, some things that we should really think about putting together. The first link I'm pointing to here is ready.gov, and it's specifically, these are tips from the U.S. government. There's a few I'm not sure I totally agree with, but by and large, it's a very good resource and gives some great ideas of things that we should think about. When we say emergency, what does that mean? It doesn't snow where I live. I don't live near the ocean, so I don't have hurricanes. But, you know, in addition to snowstorms, ice storms, which can take out electricity for long periods of time, as happened here last year, there were counties in Kentucky where the whole county was basically evacuated. As there would be no power for 2 to 4 weeks. You have tornadoes that can rip through an area and cause damage, eliminating electricity for extended periods of time. Of course, you have hurricanes in the south, but also you can have fires, you can have floods, explosions, something people don't think about. And of course, as our government would remind you, of course, are always susceptible to a possible terrorist type of attack where some chemical would be released into the environment. No matter where you live, you are exposed to the possibility of some disruption of your utilities or your normal day-to-day living environment. Let's talk about some of the things we should have in our kit. 1 gallon of water per person per day for 3 days. Keep in mind, you're not also just talking about drinking water. You're also talking about sanitation. So I think the big area I disagree with here is 3 days, because that might work in some situations, but if you're staying put in your home environment, I would plan for a longer period of time personally. I would go for 1 to 2 weeks. And I guess if your finances allow it, why not a month or two? And I'll talk later about a book that I read, which really got me thinking about this whole idea of emergency preparedness. 3 gallons of water, minimum, 3 gallons of water per person. Non-perishable foods, and later we'll go into specifically what foods fall into that category. Battery-powered or hand crank radio, preferably one that can actually pick up the NOAA weather channel and may also have the alarm capabilities so it can be sounded if there are new emergencies transmitted. Extra batteries, a very good idea. And although many listening are blind, yes, have that flashlight with some extra batteries, because remember, we're working as a team here to resolve whatever issues. Just because we don't need it, odds are we're going to be working with someone who will. So why not have that flashlight and those batteries? One thing it talks about is having a whistle, which some people might think is strange, but imagine if you were in an earthquake. That's kind of what I'm prone to in this area here, where you could, or even a tornado, where you could be trapped. There might be people outside going around looking for people, and you might need some way to communicate with them. So it talks about having a whistle as a way to get their attention, because the high frequencies can travel through walls and can be heard at some distance. Bust mask. What we're talking about here is protecting yourself should the air itself be contaminated. An explosion, a fire, a release of any kind of toxic chemicals could certainly poison the air that you have to breathe. And then it talks about getting into actually using plastic sheeting, and your friend, everyone should have some of this, some good old duct tape, always a use for it at one time or another. Sealing up your windows and maybe even doors, places where you know a lot of air is seeping in, or maybe even your air ducts. If you're in a situation where you have to make a localized shelter and try to, as best as you can, isolate yourself from the what has become toxic air outside. Wrench and pliers. Well, it's always a good idea to have some tools on hand, and if you don't have any, you can go out and buy a pretty economical tool set for $20 or $30. At least you have something. And the reason they're talking about wrench and pliers is to shut off your utility valves. That could be water in the event that you have a leakage. I suspect most likely we're talking about gas lines, because those certainly, in an explosion or an earthquake or even a tornado, it'd be something that we need to get disabled very quickly. And so I challenge you, if you are in a home, or maybe you have just taken residence of a new apartment and you're not sure where these are, to find out so that you have the ability to turn off your water or gas in the event that there is this kind of catastrophe and maybe you've got a leak or something. And it talks about sanitation, and that's something to give some serious thought to. Not one of the most exciting topics, but you know, some things you want for that, including garbage bags, plastic ties, and some moist towelettes for your hands, ways to dispose of your toxins there. Manual can opener, local maps, and there's a few reasons for that, one of which is that the regular roadways that people use could either be blocked, or they could be so congested by everyone using the main thoroughfares to relocate that it's a good policy to have some alternate ways. So even if you yourself don't drive, maybe you have a spouse or a family member, so you have the tool there available so you can find some alternate roads to get to where you need to go. Prescriptions and having any medications on hand that you're going to need for a few days. Eyeglasses, if relevant. If you have a small child, a baby, actually having infant formula and diapers, if that's relevant. Of course, then there's the issue of pets, you know, having some pet food. If you have a dog, maybe a service animal, which they have to allow in the shelters, but any other animals might be allowed, but oftentimes are not. So you'll need to have some provisions of what to do with your pets. You need to allocate extra water for your pets as well. It talks about actually having some cash. A lot of people today have migrated to the cashless society and just do everything with plastic, either credit card or debit card. It talks about having cash and change, as well as maybe some kind of traveler's check, so that you have money. Technologies are altered where credit cards have no value, because either you have no electricity or something has altered the computer systems. There's a credit card issued by the French that inconvenienced 30 million people when we rolled over to 2010. It quit working. Mainly, I think, over in Germany and in Europe. Always good to have some cash on hand, definitely. Talks about having your important documents with you. Having a few waterproof containers, one of them for your documents. What kind of things? Well, of course, your identification, your bank account records, in some kind of portable container. It's small enough that you can transport with you, but is kind of protected from water so that these important pieces of paper don't get soiled and become unreadable. Another important thing is sleeping bags or warm blankets, with one for each person. And of course, some of that's going to depend on where you live, but it definitely mentions if you live in a colder climate, having some additional bedding. And they do make sleeping bags, I think they go down to like 20 or 30 below zero. Even if you're in Minnesota, or they're in the Dakotas right now, where I understand they have wind chills of 52 below, you could actually be kind of a weird concept living in a sleeping bag. It makes a difference of life or death. You know, why not? You do what you got to do. And there are stores or places, you know, like there's one that just opened here called The Bunker. So there are stores you can go to that specialize in this if you just want to know all of your options, all of the different foods that you can buy and different supplies, stoves and water purification, economical things I've seen for like under $100 that includes a stove and water purification. There's a lot of options out there, whether you want to go online or look in your local community. There's a lot of things that we can do where that is concerned. Talks about having a complete change of clothing for each person. So at least one, maybe a few more. Again, some of this obviously comes down to the limitations of, you know, when you're traveling, what you can feasibly take with you. And especially in our case, if we're not driving, then it has to be a few bags, enough content that we can carry with us. But in those changes of clothing, actually having long sleeve shirts and long pants. And most importantly, sturdy shoes. And if you can do it, have multiple pairs of shoes. Because if you have to travel a lot, you're going to find out how valuable your shoes are, not how valuable your feet are. Household chlorine bleach. Also a medicine dropper. And the reason is bleach, of course, among other things, is a disinfectant. So you can use this diluted 9 parts water to 1 part bleach. So if you need to clean to disinfect any areas, you can actually treat water. So in a worst case scenario, you could make water drinkable. Hopefully you would never have to do this, but if you did, it talks about using 16 drops of bleach per 1 gallon of water. And if you don't have the medicine dropper there, I saw it listed somewhere else as a tablespoon. So you have that as another measuring device to do that for 1 gallon of water, and obviously make sure that it's mixed very, very well. But you have to be careful. You can't just use any bleach. You don't want to use scented bleach or any bleach that's labeled as color safe, because obviously it has some additives, or any bleach with added cleaners to it. You want pure, the real thing here, bleach for that. Ample supply of feminine supplies, of course, and any other personal hygiene items. Mess kits, things like paper cups and paper plates, paper towels, and plastic utensils so that you can eat. Paper and pencil, I guess some pens there, so that you have the means to write. So what would that be for us? Well, we're not going to have a computer or a portable device. We take our portable device, but remember, our battery life's going to be limited. It's a question of whether you're writing notes for someone else or doing something for yourself. That time in an emergency that I think about, I wish I'd spent a little bit more time with the Slayton stylus. Kids, books and games and puzzles and things to keep your children occupied. Also mentions having a fire extinguisher, because certainly when you have a disaster, you have the increased potential of fires. Talks about keeping some matches, having matches in a waterproof container. It doesn't mention a lighter, and I assume the reason for that is obviously gas leaks, where flicking your Bic could have a very explosive response, certainly once you're away in a safe environment. Now we get into items for persons, or things to keep in mind for persons with disabilities. Those are all just general for everyone, and we're a part of that as well. So those are the basics. One is to contact your city or county government FEMA office. It says that many offices keep a list of people with disabilities. Those agencies can come to you if there's some major emergency and you need transport to shelter. Creating a support network if you don't have one. And that's something always to think about. Who can you rely on? Are you fortunate enough to have family members or friends, or neighbors, people you can trust? And then these next suggestions are things you have to really proceed with caution, talking about telling them where you keep your emergency supplies, because obviously this is going to be someone you trust, because if a disaster goes on for a prolonged period of time, someone might decide they need those supplies more than you. So better make sure it's someone you trust. And with the next suggestion as well, giving someone a key to your home or apartment in case you need assistance and you're not there. Maybe you're trapped away. You happen to be at work or somewhere else at the time that the disaster takes place. This is one I'm not sure about. It may depend on the type of disability, but it talks about wearing medical alert tags or bracelets. Those of us who are blind, of course, either have a cane or a dog, so that makes us pretty identifiable. So they may be talking about other types of disabilities where it is more critical, maybe people with breathing problems. If you need dialysis or other life-sustaining treatment, it is important to know the location and availability of more than one place. So there's a place you regularly go to, but let's assume that the disaster events have either closed that facility or made it impossible for you to reach that facility. So you might want to know the nearest few locations for dialysis or whatever kind of life-sustaining services you need so that you can get some assistance. Showing others how to operate your wheelchair. So anyone listening who does use a wheelchair, knowing the size and weight of the wheelchair, and very important if it's collapsible, because it may need to be transported. So it's very important to know if that can be done. And one of the big things finally here on this topic is persons receiving any kind of government benefits, Social Security, SSI, if you haven't done so already, really talks about encouraging electronic payments of those federal benefits, because it points out that disasters can disrupt mail for days at a time, even weeks. It talks about how there were over 85,000 people who did not get their checks from the devastation from Hurricane Katrina. Of course, it also eliminates the risk of any checks being stolen. Prescriptions, the medicines, and a list of any allergies, a list of the medications, including their dosages, hearing aid batteries, extra eyeglasses, wheelchair batteries, and of course, oxygen. Some more important papers, your medical insurance, Medicare cards if relevant, something with your policy in case you need medical services, a list and style of the serial numbers of the medical devices you use, a list of doctors, relatives, and friends, basically people that you want to make sure are notified in the event that you are hurt. Now let's talk about the types of food. These suggestions are talking about a 3-day supply. Again, I would say preferably more if at all possible, especially if you're staying put. I mean, it talks about having two kinds of emergency strategies, one for your home and then one that's something you can pick up and take with you. And obviously there's compromises in what you can transport with you. You know, unless, of course, you're traveling by car. But if you're on foot, you're without eyesight and don't have the benefit of having others with you, then you have to really streamline what you do. Make sure that nothing has expired, spoiled, or changed so that your food is still intact. A lot of the food can have lives, believe it or not, up to 25 years. What are non-perishable foods? Well, certainly anything that does not require refrigeration. So you don't want to take anything that would require refrigeration, preparation, or require cooking that uses little or preferably even no water at all if possible. Of course, having that manual can opener and then your utensils. Then it talks about avoiding salty foods, which could make you thirsty. Choosing foods, obviously, that your family or others that you're with will eat. What would these foods include? These would be ready-to-eat canned meats, fruits, and canned vegetables, protein bars or fruit bars, dry cereal, granola, peanut butter, dried fruit, nuts, crackers, canned juices, food for infants if you have any, vitamins, non-perishable pasteurized milk, high-energy foods. And finally, what they call comfort/stress foods. These would be things, hopefully, that fall into this category because you are, obviously, if you're relocated from your home or even if you're at home and you have family members, and of course, everyone's going to be stressed, you have a very abnormal situation. Having some things that you enjoy eating wouldn't be bad either. I want to show this, keeping food safe during an emergency, congregating your food together, and if your freezer is full, that somehow that will help it last longer. The items will keep each other cool, so you can get maybe up to 48 hours that way, or maybe getting some dried ice to give you 2 days of storage, or if you're fortunate enough to have some kind of basement area, you know, that maybe you can keep your food, but it really talks about you need to keep it within 40 degrees, because anything between 40 and 140 is where your bacteria kicks into place. First question. Okay, Matt McCubbin points out that weatherusa.net, so this is a tool for those who do not have weather radios that will let you know of weather emergencies. So the only thing I would add to that is that's a great tool under normal circumstances, which we're going to be in 99.999% of the time. However, when an emergency strikes, it takes out our electricity. And then our computer usage is not going to be there. However, they can send you some cell phone alerts. And that's one thing I don't believe I mentioned was it talked about having not only your cell phone, but actually having chargers. If you have more than one charger or some of them have those little USB devices so that you can power, you know, their standard 5 volts so they can power and charge your cell phone. Kind of a handy little gizmo to have. We appreciate this resource here. WeatherUSA.net to get those NOAA weather alerts sent via email or I think even via your cell phone. Here's the next question. Jamal asks if the alerts would be via text message or phone call.
I believe weather.com for a fee does offer phone call type weather alert.
Yeah, I would think that technology would be there where right, you could have an automated recording that could call your cell phone. So right, if you don't have text messaging capability so that it could give you some kind of alert. Now, another thing that was mentioned, and I thought this was kind of interesting, it was talking about keeping a landline phone. And a lot of people have eliminated landline phones. This got my attention. It makes sense because we had a tornado here about 4 years ago. Killed 23 people, and everybody was using the cell phone, so even at 4 o'clock in the morning, they were not working. You'd almost have to try for 2 hours before you could even grab a space on the tower and make a phone call. But I recently seen where AT&T is asking the FCC to relieve them. Basically, they want to get rid of landline phones altogether because they claim it is, you know, a financial burden. A lot of people are getting away from it, although I find it interesting that they still want to bundle it, force you to use it with their DSL. By not giving you the maximum speed DSL unless you get a landline. And I'll be curious to see if that comes up as an issue, if the FCC says, no, we're not going to get rid of the old POTS system, the plain old telephone system, because in an emergency situation, that phone might be the only thing that people can pick up. So I'll be curious to see where that's going to go, and we certainly will follow that as well. Great book at Audible, and it is actually in production to be released at the NLS. It is called 1 Second After, and it's by a man by the name of William Forstchen, Forstchen. And the premise of the book is that basically the U.S. is hit with what's called an EMP, or an electromagnetic pulse, which basically just kills the power grid. There's no electricity. Anything with a microprocessor just pretty much just ceases to exist. I mean, it's just a useless piece of junk at that point. There's no electricity. There's no communications to tell people what's going on. Radio and TV's totally gone. Airplanes just fall out of the sky. And it talks about what would happen in society. I don't know, some people could argue, but I thought it was very realistically done. This gentleman, Mr. Forstgen, did real research on what would happen based on other tragedies that have happened in the world that has disrupted their communications. Great book. I would highly recommend people read it. Gives you something to think about. I mean, it talks about how basically we have at best 30-day supply of food and what's going to happen once that runs out. The only vehicles that can run are maybe those vehicles before 1980 when they all went computerized. You might have all the great crops in the Midwest, but you can't get them to the rest of the people who need them. Let's look at this question here. Jess asks about weather radio apps for the iPhone. There are weather radio apps for the iPhone. There's a number of them, actually. I think there's one just called Weather Radio. But also some of the regular radio applications have the NOAA weather channels listed with their appropriate cities. Some of the scanner apps also include the weather channel. So most, not all, but many of the NOAA weather feeds are broadcast on the internet, and there are iPhone apps to pick those up as well. Scott Rakowski mentioned something called Echofon, Echofon. And the reason I mention that is, you know, it occurred to me that in a disaster, Twitter could really be the way, as long as you have the ability to communicate. You either still have cell service or, you know, have internet connectivity to find out what's going on and having people actually report and learning a lot more than you're going to get via radio or television. The iPhone, that's good as long as it's alive. And again, the problem you're going to have with cell phone coverage is even if it's working, it's not designed for everyone to use it simultaneously. You're going to expect there's going to be disruptions in service.
Brought up the EMP situation, and they talked a lot about terrorist attack, nuclear attacks possibly happening in the future. There has been talk that devices made out of rubber could possibly be a solution to solving the electromagnetic pulse.
I know there are ways to isolate it, but I understand that's a pretty expensive process, so I would be surprised if just rubber itself could do that.
Chess?
Okay, your comment.
Say, hypothetically, that all the cell towers went down, we had no electricity. How would we as blind people, you know, reach the outside?
Let me finish what I was saying about the book from William Forstgen, because that's what prompted this whole discussion tonight, I think, ultimately. And that combined with just the fact that this is kind of one of the worst winters in 80 years. But that's what the book talks about, is that basically you get a situation where at best you've got 30 days. And in this book, the scenario, that basically 1 year after the event would take place, assuming it couldn't be restored, 80 to 90% of society would basically cease to exist because your food could not get to the places it needed to. And, you know, the only vehicles that are going to work are probably pre-1980, 70s, 60s models. Maybe some could be modified. You have a situation of anarchy. And then you have a situation of, you have dogs, of course, that just kind of run in packs and either attack people, or you have gangs that actually travel from community to pilfer and get anything they can, food and supplies to live and exist. You're then in a situation of, even if you had a year or two's worth of food, are you able or are you willing to take someone else's life who's willing to take your life for those supplies? I would highly recommend reading this book. I mean, this book will make you think. You know, and I didn't even want to go there tonight, because if you're talking EMP, that's totally beyond what we can even cover here, because then it's every man, it's every person for themselves. And what are you willing to do? Are you willing to eat grass from the ground? Are you willing to consume bugs or animals? Would you eat your dog? Would you eat your cat if that meant living a few more days? That's a book to read. That might be another topic. I'd be curious if anyone in this room actually owns or knows how to use a firearm and would be willing to take those measures to protect yourself. This varies from state to state. There are blind hunters in Michigan, and I'm sure many other states. And I know people in Alaska, you know, where hunting are much more common. Arguably, a blind person might have an advantage, because when the lights are out, all you have to work with is sound. Maybe there's an email list I'm not aware of blind firearms owners. I think that would be an interesting tech chat to talk about that and the responsibility of it and the obstacles that people may have had to deal with in getting their license.
Peter Bosley.
Yes, Peter. What's on your mind tonight, sir?
I have a firearm, and it was challenging to get it because there was obviously some hesitation on the part of law enforcement and the actual owners of the gun store, but I went and did it the legal way, and I went and took the test in the class and got my concealed carry permit. And I think that it's, you know, it's really a matter of how responsible you feel you can be for your actions. You carry a firearm, you own a firearm, and you are responsible for anything that happens consequently.
Now, what about the, aren't there like targets that you have to shoot? You go out in some kind of shooting range or something like that? Is that an obstacle?
Well, I have vision. I'm not totally blind, and I have enough that I could navigate that. Now, Ohio requires that you have 4 hours of practical range time, so you have to be able to hit a target. So I don't know, you know, how that would work for somebody that couldn't see it.
Is it protection? What motivated you to do that?
It's home protection. I've suffered a couple of break-ins, and I was actually robbed in person at one point several years back.
Concealed, so it's something you carry with you? Is it something you take to work?
So I work for a public university, and we aren't allowed to carry weapons on campus. So when I'm not home, it's locked up in a pistol safe that's next to my bed. If I go somewhere and I carry it, then I, you know, carry it in a holster.
I assume there have been probably some cases presented in the courts that we go and look through for blind persons trying to get the rights for firearms and have either been denied or were not aggressive enough or just, you know, had the issues of the shooting range. I just figured that would be the biggest obstacle to making it happen.
That was to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon in public. Now, you as a citizen can own a gun and keep it in your own house, and most places don't require anything more than a background check.
Okay, so I can go down here to Nigel's Guns in Evansville and get a gun just to bring into my home for protection, as long as I'm not taking it out of the home.
Now, whether the gun shop will let you do that, you know, they may have some hesitation of their own, and you may end up having to fight them on that. I had that problem.
People probably stereotype and assume that a gun shop will sell to almost anyone. So you've had gun shops actually be uncomfortable with wanting to sell you a firearm. And
they were afraid that I would be unsafe with it. They were afraid I was going to hurt myself or hurt someone else. And they had the best intentions.
If people were either receiving any type of government benefits and having things mailed and were concerned about security things being stolen or what have you, that link 3 here is godirect.org, and it's a place where you can sign up or you can call the toll-free number that we have here on the page and get that set up to have your benefits direct deposited. Link number 4, directexpress.com, and this is a concept that is growing in popularity. This is for people who either don't have bank accounts or may have had issues in the past. You can actually get your money converted to a debit card, and there's a lot of people that are paid that way. So instead of actually getting a paycheck, they would get a debit card for that amount, and that way they can use it and kind of know what the remaining balance is. You can build up your credit if you've had credit problems in the past. Keeps you certainly from spending money you don't have, or might be advantageous to a blind person. That way, you know, may feel more comfortable using a system like that instead of checks. But those are a few things out there. Link number 5 was emergency preparedness for people with disabilities. And it looked like, I didn't read through the full document, it's a Word document and it's quite a few pages. It looked like it was more for agencies and institutions that might be planning a community-wide type of emergency preparedness system. So if you're in that venue, or if you kind of want to look at it from the organizational standpoint, that you can pursue that and download and go through that Word document as well there. I'm going to start locally because I want to try some smaller samples and see how this stuff tastes and kind of what it looks like and get an idea of what we're talking about for storage. I know one that I've heard lately, and I'm not endorsing it here, www.efoodsdirect.com, mentioned on Coast to Coast AM, and there's a lot of podcasts and they have some seminars. So if you want to learn kind of about the whole process of purchasing stored food, get something for a couple of weeks or a month or 2 months, or you can even go a year at a time, or do these whole case lots if there's something in particular that you really like. Or this is the site I was referring to before where you can get the combination stove water filtration type system for $96. It looks like a lot of what they sell is a company called Nutraversal. Things like reasons to store food, food quality, times of shelf life, storage temperatures. You can go all vegetarian if that's what you like. Dehydrated versus freeze-dried. Preferably you want dehydrated because it makes it much smaller. You get a lot more food in a much smaller space, so you might want some freeze-dried for flavor, but if you get hardcore and planning for really a long time foods. Let's see what the question is here. Glenn asks, has anyone purchased a personal gas generator for electricity?
I went with something that could basically power my whole house, and I've got about 1,400 square feet. It's a condo, and it cost me $3,300 installed and everything, and it's run off of my natural gas line, so if that were to fail, I guess I'd have to start filling it up, but it's supposed to be able to handle everything I've got in my house and keep it going as long as there's fuel.
One thing we're going to do in the future, if there's interest in this topic, making your homes more energy efficient and really get specifically into that. Mike Cabo's done quite a bit. Of course, living in Florida, you know, it can get pretty expensive in the summertime. He's made an investment in that, not just to be green, but to save money, and actually has acquired a device. He'll be letting me and letting us know shortly about the accessibility of that basically will allow you to, on demand, kind of see what each device is using. So you can figure out what are the electricity hogs, what particular appliances, devices you own are using up most of your electricity. So you can decide, well, maybe I need to replace that device or make sure that, you know, it's turned off when not in use. Computer screens or television screens, different appliances. Peter, does that automatically kick in? Is it just like kind of roll over? And
it waits for 90 seconds and then it'll fire up. It's got what they call an automatic switch device.
Relatively new homeowners, I recall, from following you on Twitter. I'm seeing a tech chat there as well, because I tell you, when I bought my first home, that was a live and learn experience. And every home has a surprise or two. That's just the way it is. But I think your first one, it's like, wow, you know, you wish you'd done this, wish you'd done that. Well, we always are welcoming and looking for your ideas for future tech chats. Resources at cerotalk.com, or you can call the Blab line, 866-997-BLAB, which is 2522 is the phone number for that. And we hope you'll join us. If you haven't heard it yet, we instead of a regular podcast, we did, I guess, what we're calling a documentary. As we kind of approached 10 years, even though 2010 is not technically the new decade, but it is kind of for Cerotech in the sense that Mike Cabo has been working on accessibility for 10 years, beginning with Radio Webcaster, and we had conversations in 99 about kind of going to the next level. So we kind of created what we called Cerotech Story Part 1. Maybe I should have left off the part one. That seems to confuse people. Obviously, what I meant by that is to present, and with part two obviously being at some point in the future as we have more innovations to share and kind of go to the next level. It's 66 minutes downloaded and burn it to a CD and hope you'll share it with other people. It's good because it doesn't just tell the history of Cerotech. It also kind of gives you insights into the vision, the thinking and the logic that Mike and the staff have and why we approach things the way that we do. And I think when you understand the philosophy of a company, it makes a lot more sense to how you can end up going down a similar yet very different path to get to the same place. I think it's very interesting, and I hope you'll check that out over at cerotalk.com.
This is Jamie. I just wanted to say that documentary is quite good. I listened to that late the other night, and it was quite well done. I was very impressed.
Well, thank you very much. It's Jamie Pauls with Main Menu, and you're doing a great job over there. I might add the most recent one that talks about what you thought were some of the highlights or lowlights, or really some of the top tech stories for 2009 in terms of access technology, and you had a great panel of folks involved with that. So check that out, and join us next week and every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the Cerotalk Tech Chat. And until then, stay connected and stay directed.